This Friday, Jamaican Association.
La vaccination contre la COVID-19 se poursuit partout au Québec. L'effet combiné des deux doses assure une meilleure efficacité du vaccin, en plus de réduire le risque d'avoir et de transmettre le virus. Vous serez aussi protégé sur une plus longue période. Il est primordial de vous présenter à votre rendez-vous pour la deuxième dose du vaccin, peu importe ce qu'il y a d'autre à votre horaire. La deuxième dose du vaccin est essentielle. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
The Association des services de réhabilitation sociale du Québec is filing a class action suit. If you were strip searched between July 13, 2006 and July 1, 2011, if you were in one of the following facilities, Bordeaux, Rivière-des-Prairies, Roberval, Saint-Jérôme, or the male sector of Quebec City, you may be able to be part of this claim. For complete details, go to asrsq.ca/class action. That's asrsq.ca/class action. Claims must be filed before January 16th, 2022.
CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to Labor Radio. Today is August 19th, 2021. You're tuned in to CKUT 90.3 FM. We're here every third Thursday of the month between 5 and 6 p.m. On your radio dial, as well as online at ckut.ca. You can find us also on Facebook and Mixcloud. And we're also proud members of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, which you can find online at laborradionetwork.org. which is Labor with No U, because it's based in the U.S. There's almost 100 shows on that network. A few really amazing ones. One out of BC I just want to highlight real quick, On the Line, Stories of BC Workers. It's put together by the, I believe it's the BC Federation of Labor Heritage Center, something like that. But a really cool sort of historical podcast about BC workers. Anyway, check them out. This month, we're without Mustafa. He's absent because his wife, Ola, just gave birth a couple weeks ago. So congratulations to them and their family. And we'll probably see Mustafa again next month. But it's just me today. This edition, we'll be talking about Cuba and the labor movement there, as well as their labor movement's relationship with the one in Canada, as well as the Canadian Labor Congress's convention from last June. Lots happening in the news regarding labor, as always, but to be honest, it's just not the same bantering by myself, so I'm not going to really get into that too much. Only just to say to watch the conflict at Unimel in Vallée-Jonction, which is, they just had an agreement in principle, and I think they're voting on it this week. So maybe by the time this episode's actually on the air, you'll actually know what happened there. But definitely keep your eyes on what's going on over there. Over 100 days on strike for over 1,000 meat cutters. Very important strike. So otherwise, federal election coming up. See what any of these clowns have to propose to labor and what labor has to propose to them. In any case, I'm just going to let the episode roll. We got these two interviews. Really looking forward to sharing them with you. Thanks for tuning in. Enjoy the episode. And see you in a bit.
Comme des A, je suis fier de ma ville comme Soso Manès. Les schlags font d'alluche dans la neige, c'est minimum 30 euros le tour de manège. Et je produis mon produit. Deux, trois directives, c'est la rue qui manage. 24 par les salles, je peux pas faire le ménage. Elle est choquée de voir comment je la baisse pour mon âge.
You're still listening to Labor Radio here on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Lucky enough to be joined by Don Foreman. He's with the Canadian Union of Postal Workers. And deeply involved for decades now in Cuban solidarity work. So in the context, I mean, it seems like the storm has kind of blown over, at least in terms of what happened on July 11th. But in the context of all this news and focus on Cuba, and particularly lots of criticism of Cuba, I thought it'd be a good time to talk about labor and Cuba. And so lucky to have someone with a lot of experience on the matter to sort of tease out the different facets of it, whether it's like relationship between Canadian trade unions and Cuban trade unions, or just Cuban trade unions in Cuban society. So welcome to the show, Don. Do you want to start off by just telling us a little bit about the work that you've done, sort of to place us in the context of what you know and what you've been involved with?
Well, I guess the work I originally started with was on the Cuban Five, actually. That's how I originally got involved with Cuba back in 1997. I went to a meeting and learned about the case of the Cuban Five in American prisons, and that got me involved with Cuba. From that point on, I think my first visit to Cuba was in 2003. And that's where we attended May Day and met with the Cuban delegation and met with Cuban postal workers and their union. And ever since then, it's become pretty well an annual thing that I partake in. There's not many years that I haven't partaken in that. And we've kept alliances with the Cuban postal workers and CPW now for over 35 years, actually. We've had visits back and forth, and we've had them here, and we've gone to visit them many a times. So that's kind of how I got involved, and I've just never been uninvolved since.
Great. Well, I was in a meeting maybe about a month ago now, just a little, yeah, about a month ago, where we were talking someone was mentioning about these links between Canadian labor unions and Cuban labor unions. And I mean, to me, as someone who's, you know, broadly sympathetic with the Cuban struggle, I was completely unaware about that. And I think it kind of flies in the face of sort of what people expect, maybe. Not that people necessarily expect Canadian unions to be hostile to Cuba, but you know, it's not a relationship that's like extremely public necessarily. And it definitely doesn't reflect sort of what the CBC projects or other, you know, big mainstream Canadian institutions. So can you talk a little bit about the history of the linkages between the two national labor movements?
Well, in specific to CUPW, the relationship started with the Cuban postal workers before my time, like of involvement, like heavily within the union. It goes back to sometime in the early 80s when it was actually started on the Atlantic region, one of the regions within CUPW who went over on a delegation and kind of formed ties with them. Brought it back to the union, and ever since then, annually, I don't think there's been a year since 1987 that we haven't sent a delegation back and forth on May Day. You know, May Day is something that's celebrated in Cuba every year, but after May Day is May 2nd is the International Conference of Trade Unions globally that happens in Havana. And at that meeting, you have unions from all over the world that actually partake in a meeting with all the, with the Cuban, it's called the CTC, I can't remember the exact words for it, but that's their Federation of Labor. So all of their unions partake, plus globally, all the unions that are there from the world take place. You know, I've met unions from just about every country that there is. Mostly it's Latin America. You do get countries like Australia, France, and a lot of African countries that take part. And North America was kind of slow to join in. We were there first as a North American union, but I've met lots of other North American unions throughout the early 2000s to now that have gone over. CUPE has formed a lot of alliances, so has the steel workers with their counterparts in Cuba. So it was at those meetings that we met our counterparts, and from there we've kind of built the relationships between each other. So we stick mainly with the postal workers, even though we get, like, for years we took over delegations, and we still do, but now we also do projects with the union itself. You know, it's a different model than we have in Canada. There's a much tighter relationship between the Cuban union and the employer than there is here in Canada. And it's one thing when we take a delegation over that they have trouble understanding, where you visit the union first, but then you go with the union and you meet with the employer. And most Canadians are like, "What? Well, why are we doing something like that?" But once you're at that meeting and you see the relationship that takes place between the two of them, you understand that there's actually a better way for labor. And Cuba's got a much stronger role of union involvement in the workplace than Canadian unions do.
Well, maybe that's a good segue to talk about the place of Canadian unions of Cuban unions in the broader Cuban society. Maybe we can start at the workplace, but even sort of politically speaking, I think that there's, you know, in terms of the constituent assemblies and the ways that the political legislative process works there, I'm pretty sure from my quick research that there's a labor involvement in legislative bodies, but correct me if I'm wrong. But anyways, do you want to talk about sort of the difference? I mean, obviously under socialism, unions, you just play a different role. That's kind of obvious, I guess, but just describe a little bit of the things that you've seen and over the years, maybe even the changes that you've seen in terms of the place of labor in society there.
Well, labor in society there is consulted on every level. Like, it's not like here, we, you know, in Canadian labor, we have a relationship of collective bargaining where we go, we meet with the employer to gain more power and wages and stuff as workers. But the Cuban workers and the employer actually work for the company to succeed. It's a different mindset altogether than we have here. When I went to my first Labor Day parade or May Day parade there, the slogan was, you know, together and into the future. And I had a hard time understanding what they meant by that. And, you know, so I asked them what they're talking about. And they explained that, you know, if they don't work collaboratively, like, for example, the post office is state owned there. You know, it's not a private post office. So if the two sides don't work collaboratively, there is no success in their minds. They don't see how the company can possibly move forward without working with them. You know, we have methods like the grievance procedure here where we file a grievance and we end up in front of, you know, an independent or a tribunal and we try to solve a problem. Whereas the two sides there actually meet and they're non-adversarial. You know, they meet to solve the problem, not to, you know, put a wall up in front and say, we're not going to do that. It's going to cost us money or, you know, their goal is to solve the problem. And, you know, they talk a lot about production, which is a strange concept for a Canadian union to listen to. That's management's line of production. But the union talks about production because without production, the company doesn't succeed. I.e. with postal workers there. So it's a collaborative effort between the two of them. And, you know, the relationship between the employer and the union is one of cooperation. Whereas here it's always adversarial, you know, where we're always at each other's throats instead of, you know, working together to solve a goal. The employer here is hell-bent on making money. That's their goal. Whereas in the Cuban society, it's completely the opposite. The goal is to have the company succeed so everybody makes money.
And it's true that, I mean, like some people do complain about labor unions in Canada or elsewhere being collaborative with the boss, but I think that they mean a very different thing than what you're describing there.
a much different, so, you know, the pay cycle for a Cuban trade unionist is much different than that of a Canadian union. You know, their wages do reflect the work floor. It's not like you take a union position, you know, whereas here, you know, and I've had this conversation with the Canadian Labor Congress where, you know, we don't eat in the same restaurants and we don't dine and we don't vacation in the same places and we don't live in the same neighborhood. A worker is working off of $60,000 a year where their representatives are making $150,000 to $200,000 a year. That doesn't take place in Cuban society. The wage scale is much closer to each other. There's not a big difference, right? So it's a much more collaborative effort and the workers are always consulted. You know, the union body itself doesn't make any decisions without meeting with the workers and asking for their input before anything's done. Even the labor code in Cuba was changed about 6 years ago now. It was actually put into law. But it took them over 2 years because they traveled the island talking to all the workers and asking all of their inputs in every single industry before creating the new labor code. You know, unlike here in Canada, the government doesn't consult us. They ask for our opinion. We can write a piece of paper, but they never come and meet with the trade unions or workers on the floor when they're creating the labor code. It's done by parliament, you know, not done with workers.
I mean, there's a particularly egregious example of that right now in Quebec with the proposed law 59, which is a whole rewriting of the work health and safety code. And it's being opposed by all the unions, but that's an example here of where the it's just being sort of thrown at people. Well, I wanted to talk a little bit because in some of my research for preparing for this interview, I came across like a couple numbers of rates of unionization in Cuban society, which were one figure was 94%, another that I saw was 98%, but that's fairly different than here. So, and even going so far as to say, you know, like people selling things on the street to tourists are unionized and so on. So can you talk a bit about the structure of unionization? So, I mean, like clearly if you're working in a sort of more traditional workplace, it might not be like surprising how people are unionized and organized. But if we're talking like such a high level of unionization, there has to be a different way that it happens. And can you explain that?
I can't go back to the actual history. Like after the revolution, the unions were disbanded in Cuba. They were corrupt. They were, and I don't want to use outright examples of, you know, when you get into American trade unions and that, but there was a lot of corruption in the labor industry where very similar to the North American style, union executives were paid a high amount of money and were in collaboration with the businesses and no involvement with the workers. So the unions were actually disbanded and they were started all over again. And every place was unionized. Every place was given the right to unionize and form their own union and become involved in the system. And that's what happened. So, I mean, you know, and as you said at the beginning, unions aren't only involved with the company itself, but their representatives are also involved with provincial, municipal, federal governments, where they actually have a place at the table when something's being discussed or a law is being changed. Even in parliament, they have a place at the table where their voices are heard. So it's a much different structure. And that's, I think, you know, when we say that they have an 80 to 90% unionized rate, it's because everything in Cuba is unionized. All workers have a say in what happens. They don't have the same structure here of the union dues and everything else, because part of the income of any company goes back to the union to fund the union's funded by the state more or less. It's, you know, because all the companies are owned by the state until the private sector was opened up. So the state gives back money to the company gives back money to the union, and it's not based off of union dues like it is here. The workers pay a very small percentage of their wages to the union. The funding comes directly from the government. So it's a much different system. The interesting part was when they opened up the private sector about 12 years ago, when they changed the laws and allowed people to open their own businesses. I think the last I heard, it was around 70% of them had joined unions as well. Like they had formed their own unions because they saw the benefit in working with the government in order to keep their businesses alive and striving, like restaurants and, you know, the street vendors. I mean, even the musicians there are all unionized, right? It's rare that you find somebody that isn't. The person that, you know, is selling espresso at the corner, they're probably not in a union. But the last time I was there a year ago, we met with, or not a year, it would be 2 years now. There was a new cell phone group, you know, young kids that get into repairing cell phones and everything. And they were talking about why they formed a union and why they got involved. And it was basically all along the same principle, because if you stay private, you have no say, you have no seat at the table. So by joining a collective or a union together, they actually get a seat at the table when any laws are changed or any new mechanisms. And, you know, every year, more and more of the economy in Cuba has opened up to private enterprise. And it's not just unions, like big cooperatives have been formed there too. Like the taxis have formed a big cooperative rather than a union. And they're still unionized, but they work in a, you know, kind of like a co-op instead of working as an independent company. They pool their resources together in order for the greater good of all, right? So
I wanted to talk a little bit about the blockade and things that the labor movement globally has done to put pressure on the United States to put an end to their genocidal blockade. If there's activity on the Canadian labor front in that direction. I mean, you mentioned that QP has a relationship, that CUPW has a relationship, the steelworkers, I think also UFCW. Like, are Canadian unions involved in any of this? And to what level are they involved? And then just globally,
yeah, I can't speak for, you know, other unions and what they do exactly. I mean, I know what some of them try to do, and it's through their American counterparts. You know, like the steelworkers, for example, is an international union, right? So, you know, the Canadian steelworkers are much more active with Cuba than the American steelworkers are. But through the Canadian activity with Cuba, it's encouraged the Americans. When Obama changed the rules and lightened up in a little bit of the restrictions, you saw a lot more American unions all of a sudden over in Cuba. And, it, you know, people think they aren't there, but they are there. Every year that I've been down there, different American unions have managed to find a way to get down there, whether it's through Mexico, whether it's through Canada. We, you know, the United States with the postal workers are two separate unions. You know, they have the inside workers union, which is APUW, and then they have the letter carriers union. It's much easier with the inside workers to talk about Cuba than it is with the letter carriers union in the U.S. The letter carriers union in the U.S., they employ a lot of military. And, you know, from that comes brainwashing kind of effect on what they've listened to instead of what they've experienced. And, you know, the mantra in the U.S. against Cuba is very loud in comparison to Canada. You know, there's always this constant talk of communism, socialism, you know, everything's evil, and 90 miles away from here, we have this evil sort of thing. Our last national president actually would, you know, he asked the letter carriers when he was invited to their convention, can I talk about Cuba? And they told him, no, you know, our membership won't take that well if you stand on the stage. So he didn't, but he wore a T-shirt of Che Guevara instead. You know, and he gave a speech in a T-shirt kind of indicating where his support was, right? So there are different ways with the inside postal workers. We've managed to make ties with them, and they're against the blockade. Everybody understands it just affects workers, and most of the unions there also understand that it's good for them. Like, business would be good for them, trade would be good for them, and none of them really understand why this blockade is still in effect even. But the unions in the United States have little power over government. The same as, you know, I've met with every Canadian politician I can think of on the subject, and they always listen, but they always say, well, there's not much we can do. It's the U.S. They're the ones that you have to convince. So I've met with U.S. politicians, and quite frankly, they've told me, until you can vote for me, there's not much point in me listening to you, you know. And it's, you know, we've went on delegations, and I've went with American unions and talked to congressmen, and, you know, as they say, they listen to their constituents. So if their constituents tell them that the blockade should end, then they'll vote in favor of it. And, you know, the American unions have had quite a bit of success now with turning at least at the municipal level of having governments recognize the fact. And, you know, to see the farmers' unions very involved, and the farmers want trade with Cuba. So, it, you know, they try as hard as they can, but the movement in Miami and the political situation of Florida carries a lot of weight when it comes to U.S. presidential elections, as we all know. And it's kind of, you know, it's unfortunate that that dynamic exists, where the state of Florida seems to be a swing state and having that vote. And the reality is they don't need the Cuban vote. The Cuban vote is split there. You know, yes, 70% of Cubans there want to see Cuba different, but there's another 35 to 40% that don't. They want relations to turn to normal. They want to just be able to go back and forth and visit with their families. And they want to see Cuban society actually, you know, make their own decision on what should happen, right? So it's the fear of socialism, the fear of communism, or whatever the Americans want to call it, but the blockade serves no purpose other than political, you know, and that's the sad part about them not lifting it. It, you know, the Cold War ended how long ago, and, you know, they've made friends with Vietnam, they've made friends and traded with Russia, but yet this small little island that has absolutely no threat to them whatsoever. And I mean, Trump in his last 3 or 4 months added them back to the state-sponsored terrorism list. For why? There is no grounds or basis ever. In fact, it was the U.S. that engaged in terrorism against Cuba and allowed, you know, terrorist activities. And, you know, Luis Posada Calares, you know, he just passed away, I believe, but, you know, he's a known bomber of the Cuban airline that killed the fencing team. Yet he lived comfortably and walked the streets of Miami up to the point he died. You know, so it's something we all hope will end. But even Joe Biden, I don't see him having the same will as Obama had. You know, not that Obama wanted to change things. He just wanted to do it a different way. You know, so, you know, Cuba's still one of those countries where it's too close for socialism to work.
Right. Yeah. Well, I guess in closing, is there anything that you can recommend to listeners to learn? I mean, there's like a lot of resources just for an average Canadian. The Canadian Network on Cuba is a great website with all kinds of information, but more specifically around the labor issue, whether it's about labor in Cuba or labor relations between Canada and Cuba.
The best way for Canadians to actually learn about that is to go and get involved with the labor movement there. You know, we used to, and we still take delegations there, but as a union now, we have projects with our postal workers there. They don't have the resources that we do. So we finance a lot of things that go on. We built two schools over in Havana, one in Havana and one in another province, where they now do union education and they're able to teach their workers and, you know, more about their collective rights, their collective agreement, their health and safety. And I think it's imperative that trade unions actually invest in their partners over there. We're very privileged on this side of the, you know, the globe, where we have a lot of finances. Instead of spending it on, you know, traveling the globe, we've decided to invest our money into projects. CUPW is a little bit different. We don't use membership money for international solidarity. We actually have it negotiated into our collective agreement, where every year the employer gives us $200,000, and it's solely guided for just postals. We can't use that money for anything else except postal unions globally. So we help the Cuban Postal Union build itself up to a point where, you know, they have a better infrastructure and they're able to educate their workers better. There's not a lot to read out there on the Canadian labor movement if you don't understand Spanish. Not a lot. Arnold Lagos from Quebec there, he's written several books on democracy in Cuba and everything like that. And, you know, he has a very good source there on trying to understand how Cuban society works better. But I think the best way is to engage with them. I would invite any trade unionist on their bucket list to attend meeting. It's something that, you know, to see 500 to 750,000 people all march in unison together is something we never see here. Labor Day in Canada is, you know, people go to the cottage. They don't come out to the streets. I live in Ottawa, where all the public sector unions are, and yet there's, what, 300-400 of us every day on the street for Labor Day here while everybody's at the cottage. That's not like Cuban society. You know, right across the island, millions and millions of workers participate in May Day every year because they understand the power of workers and how much power workers can hold. In Cuba, it's quite simple. If the boss is being bad, they just stop digging the hole. And the boss has to change the policy very quickly or else none of the work gets done. And Canadians can learn a lot from that. There's another way than the model we have here. And I would encourage any Canadian to go over and try and understand how that society actually works and operates, right?
Well, thanks so much, Don, for coming on the show. I'd love to talk more. Maybe we will one day again. But is there anything else that you want to share? Any resources or where people can find you?
Where they can find me, you know, I'm stationed at 377 Bank here in Ottawa, Don Foreman at CUPW-STTP.org. I'm always willing to help out when it comes to the Cuban cause. And it's not about the government. It's not about, you know, it's about people to people and worker to worker that we're more concerned about. Cubans will decide their own fate. They always have. You know, it's not up to us to change their government or tell them what form of government they should have. But as workers, we have a responsibility of international solidarity together as workers for the common betterment of workers everywhere. And the Cuban model can teach all of us a better way to deal with the employer than we currently do.
Thank you.
No problem.
Un coup de whisky, si, un coup de vodka, un coup de bière.
So you're listening to Labor Radio here on CKUT, and I'm lucky to be joined by Sean McNeil, a trade unionist from Ontario, who wears a lot of different hats, but is notably a member of the Action Caucus within the CLC. We're going to be talking about the Canadian Labor Congress convention that happened in last June. I know we're a bit late covering this, but that's just how it happened with our schedule. But so thanks so much for joining us, Sean. Do you want to introduce yourself a bit more and maybe talk about your first impressions of the CLC Congress, which, you know, was a few months ago, but now we have a bit of hindsight for it too.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm a very active union leader in Public Service Alliance of Canada, which is like our umbrella union, as well as my component, Canada Employment and Immigration Union. And I also sit at my Labour Council. So I'm very involved with union affairs. This was my first Canadian Labour Congress convention. I did attend the Ontario Federation of Labour in November 2019, and I found them to be, you know, very similar for better and worse in terms of impressions. The OFL convention was in person. This was an online convention. So it, of course, has many limitations in and looks quite a bit different from a physical convention, because you lose that sense of, you know, physical camaraderie with the member the members who are there, and some of the dramatic moments that I think people either fear or look forward to in a convention, those kind of get stripped away when things are online, and there's not a whole lot that can be done really about that. Other than that, as far as the convention itself, I found it very expected, kind of lots of verbose language, lots of rhetoric on grassroots support, mobilization, engagement, but lacking in the details of where exactly the CLC and the union movement is going to go in terms of how it allocates resources, how it changes the actual structure of decision making, and the action orientation of the union movement. That stuff tends to be left on the cutting room floor.
Right. So, and I should mention also, so we're recording our show's broadcast in Quebec, primarily for a Montreal audience, but so being that Quebec's labor movement is not entirely cut off from the CLC, but is like largely still cut off. Some people in Quebec and Montreal pay less attention to it, but it is sort of like the structuring labor body of the rest of Canada's labor movement. So that's part of why we, even though it has like a slightly less impact on the labor movement in Quebec, we still think it's worth covering for our show here. Do you want to just go over, like, say, picture this, someone in Quebec may be less familiar with the CLC, lots of rank and file union members not that familiar with the CLC. How do you describe the convention, its impacts on like a rank and file union member, and even people outside of the labor movement who are just regular working class people? How do you put that to them?
The CLC is a federated structure, meaning that, you know, it's the highest echelon of the union movement in Canada, but it's also very weak because it does not have the ability to directly influence or whip independent unions on the direction they go. Over the last few years, we've actually seen unions basically have a disagreement with the CLC on political direction and very, very quickly just leave the CLC, and that is evidence of the fact that they don't see much consequence in not continuing their relationship with the CLC. So it's very high level. It for your rank and file members, I think rightly so, they're not aware of what's going on with the CLC, and it doesn't impact them on a day-to-day basis. But I think that there are union imaginations of a union movement where the CLC could matter more, and that it would do things that, you know, directly impact rank and file members. Because it's a big national federation of unions, it has all the same politics that I think would be very familiar to a Quebec audience, whether they're aware of the CLC or not, because we're talking about geographic differences in the economy, whether the CLC should have a political emphasis on, removing itself from the oil industry, politically speaking, or supporting the oil industry, alternative economies that are growing in kind of regionalized sectors. Things that get debated at this convention, rigorously so. But in terms of the day-to-day of the actual CLC right now, if you went to their website, what you would see is a couple glossy advertising campaigns that, you know, if they were ever successfully implemented, things like PharmaCare, absolutely they have a direct impact on members, whether they live in Quebec or British Columbia or elsewhere. But I think that it leaves much to be desired in terms of actually building a active mass movement of workers who are participating in a political project.
Right. And so a few things that we could jump off from there. And there hasn't been like tremendous coverage of the convention, and you know it's a couple months ago, so people definitely wouldn't be reading about it now. But most of the attention in the news was paid to the new leadership of the CLC, not too much on what happened or didn't happen. There was some notable exceptions to that, like particularly I think People's Voice newspaper did a fairly good breakdown of what happened at the convention, but do you want to talk about some of those like big ticket items sort of that happened at the convention, what people should be the main takeaways maybe from it?
As the Action Caucus, which is a loosely affiliated, you know, we use the term caucus, means different things in different contexts. It's a voluntary loose affiliation across various unions across Canada, and we come together around kind of some central principles of wanting to move the union movement, whether that's your union or the union movement at large, move it in an action-oriented direction. And we contrast that with the type of thing we saw in the leadership debate that did happen during the convention. We had a outgoing incumbency led by Hassan Youssef. He was basically not welcome to continue on in his role. So he did not bother reoffering. Perhaps that was his intention all along. Those who followed along will note that only days after the convention, he was welcomed in by the Liberal government as a senator to the upper chamber. This matched his kind of pro-liberal or soft on the Liberal government stance throughout his tenure, and really prevented the CLC from making any sort of inroads with workers who were being directly impacted by the policies of that Liberal government. But the group that came in and is now the leadership, they came in under a slight called Unite CLC. And I apologize, I don't have all the names off the top of my head, but it's President Bea Brusky. This is a group that, you know, very deliberately set itself in contrast with the, you know, soft support for the Liberals that was present amongst the higher ranks of CLC. But, they're not really doing anything substantially different. This is a team that is pro-NDP, but their strategy, how they're actually going to affect political change, really is not different from what came before. Because, you know, their actual campaign was completely absent of details on their platform. They had literally less than 300 words on their actual platform of what they were running on. And it was all just kind of, flowery language about the need to engage the membership, the need to fight for worker policies, but not specifics on how. And of course, you know, we've got 2 years before the next convention, and we'll see what actually transpires. My prediction and my anticipation is that we're going to see more of the same in the terms of high level marketing, high level lobbying, and you know, engagement, quote unquote, with the membership by asking them to fill out petitions. And it will move in a direction more directly aligned with trying to turn out vote for the NDP. But that's not going to be a substantial difference from what was happening before, because it's all the same tools in their toolbox: petitions, high-level lobbying in Ottawa by, you know, the most powerful members and the most privileged members of the union leadership, and matched with big glossy ad campaigns online and on television. And this is just not moving the ball for workers.
Right. You want to talk a little bit also about there was some coverage of some campaigns, or not campaigns, but resolutions that were being put forward by some of the bigger trade unions. I think the Action Caucus in particular was arguing against their adoption, because that they would have a negative impact on the democratic sort of access for smaller unions and smaller trade union councils and so on.
Yeah, so, you know, the Action Caucus looked at the leadership fight and decided that this was not something that was really what the main theme of this convention was really going to be about. That really what we wanted to focus and put an emphasis on was resolutions that would have otherwise gone undefended or not fought, because there was an attempt to just kind of get these things passed and while everybody's distracted with a leadership fight. And that often happens. There's only so many days in the convention, and you can't possibly deal with everything. And so kind of, you know, a couple big concept items become the thing that convention is about. So the Action Caucus kind of put their focus on, you know, fighting over resolutions rather than making endorsements or commenting on the leadership fight during the convention itself. And one of the big ones was a resolution. I can't recall the title, but it was a resolution to change how delegates were allocated to attend the next convention. And it would have done a couple major things, one of which was to remove local unions from the power of identifying their own credentialed delegate and give that power to the national president of that union. So I'm with PSAC, for example. Right now, if I want to go to CLC as a delegate of my local, that's between me and my local. And my local has executive has the ability to present a process, seek interest, and put a member forward as a representative of that local. This would have changed it so that PSAC would get a fixed number of delegates, and they could allocate it in whatever way they choose. Now, I'm using PSAC because that's my union. PSAC leadership, for the record, did not support this resolution. And it makes sense to me, because I certainly would not want to be a union president at the very top with all the political stress that would be involved in deciding which locals win and which locals lose. That seems chaotic, but there were clearly unions that were supportive of this. I believe NUPGE, National Union of Public and Government Employees, was the actual author of that resolution, which surprised me. They're a federated structure, just like PSAC. They've got an umbrella organization and then component unions. Most people would not know what NUPGE is. They would be familiar with the provincial unions, Alberta Labor Union, Union of Government Employees, that is, and OPSU, Ontario Public Sector Employees Union. These federate to this larger body. And so this larger body would decide how the delegates get handed out. This was part of a trend, and it already happened in the United States, AFL-CIO. This is how they do their delegates, where you are concentrating power into a smaller and smaller group of leadership. And in Canada, I feel that this is a reaction to a kind of trend parallel, which is that the membership is less and less interested in being engaged with their union. And so rather than address that problem, they are reacting to the problem and saying, well, if we can't get members, we can't do leadership development, we'll just concentrate power into a smaller and smaller group of people who are paying attention. People like myself who are very involved in the union, but you know, my involvement in the union is not so I can concentrate power and do everything that I decide is right. That is a very short thinking, and that's what we saw. And fortunately, that resolution was defeated.
Right. So before we started recording, we were just talking a bit about how you're currently at another convention, another trade union convention, and talking about other ones that you've done online. Can you talk about the online aspect of the convention, how it affects democratic debate, how it affects sort of what happens even off of the official floor? You know, like people talk a lot about what happens in these conventions after the end of the first day when people go for drinks or whatever, you know. How has that shifted the feeling? How do you think that has maybe even affected things beyond just the feeling? Like, what does it do to the CLC and maybe to the labor movement right now in general?
Yeah, you know, COVID is such this, it's this beast of a thing that, like, more and more as time goes on, our memory of exactly where was the world at prior to the pandemic lockdown is already becoming hazy. And I say that because I have to center myself and continuously remind myself that the trend in the union movement to, as I was saying with this other feature of concentrating power in small in hands, it's also trying to replace traditional organizing with electronic automated glossy solutions, whether that's petitioning, using a petition rather than a protest or a rally, doing surveys and questionnaires rather than having one-on-one engagement with workers on what are their issues and organizing them and educating them, having physical space for the union comrades to get together in a safe manner to express themselves, express their frustration about the union, not feel like they're going to, that's going to, you know, be something that gets projected into a public space that they may not otherwise be comfortable. This was stuff happening prior to COVID. COVID then accelerated it to a massive degree. And so I don't fault the unions for obviously having to do virtual conventions now. I am concerned that much of what was put in place structurally as a solution to the pandemic problem is going to conveniently keep itself around post-pandemic. I'm concerned that some conventions could remain virtual, or if not the major conventions, things like human rights council committees inside of unions, you know, something like a human rights council or a black workers caucus, a women's equity group, those not being given the same resources anymore and being told, oh, you can just do that online. Well, that does online does not replicate physical. You need to have that human interaction. You need to be able to look at somebody else in the eyes and see them as an equal and struggle together with them. That's really important. In my convention I'm in right now, Canada Employment Immigration Union National Convention, it was in fact just commented on when right before I moved to this interview by our national president that they're seeing very meager returns in terms of their online engagement strategy or efforts that they've made over COVID. So they're not seeing people sign up to newsletters. They're not seeing people engage the petitions at the numbers that they would like. I'm glad that he was transparent with that and pointed that out, because I think a lot of delegates are not necessarily thinking tactically and strategically in the same manner if they're not, if you know, their involvement with the union is, you know, they're a local president and then they show up to convention and they do their general membership meeting locally. They're not involved in, you know, a whole bunch of committees throughout the year. They need to hear that because they're struggling to get their members engaged and they may be scratching their head as to what exactly is happening or what could we do differently. So this is something that is common across the union movement is, you know, trying to contend with the malaise of membership engagement, membership even awareness that the union exists. This is a fundamental crisis of our union movement. And you know, while we have many legal protections in Canada that have certain guarantees to the existence of unions in theory, I do deeply worry about the long-term viability of the union movement if we can't turn around the imagination of workers. You know, I think about the fact that your average member joining now as a young member, I'm 34, there's people joining that now that are a completely different generation than me. And not only have they never heard about unions, it wasn't taught to them in school. If unions got brought up at all, perhaps it was in an anti-union language. You think about how many people, especially in the public sector, come from business administration training programs. But not only that, they grew up in a household that also was statistically unlikely to even be working in a union environment, let alone one of their parents being a union leader themselves. And I say that as somebody who comes from a family of union leaders, but I am, you know, the exception, not the rule. And so, you know, given all of that, given the fact that members tune out the union and then, you know, are still frustrated by how they're treated in the workplace and are open to a dialogue on and a narrative on how the workplace could be different. Well, in the meantime, the union upper leadership that has gotten to their position during this kind of decline of the union movement, so their experience looks quite a bit different because they themselves have done many things and that got them to the top of the union movement. And so they may not see it as a decline. They may see it differently. And then but they are struggling with the lack of engagement from members. And rather than contend with the very difficult fundamental and existential questions, you know, they're more inclined to want to just kind of centralize power to deal with the fallout of that and put forward alternative solutions that are kind of within reach, like, you know, hire a staff member to deliver petitions on an ongoing basis and collect data. Well, that may solve a problem, but it's not going to solve the long-term problems.
Great. Well, thanks for that very interesting overview of where you see the problems of the labor movement right now. I want to maybe have time for one last question, which could be looking forward, I guess. I know the Action Caucus was more active even in previous decades. I mean, this decade is maybe 2 years old, but I mean, over 10 years ago, but is getting a bit of a new, is getting reinvigorated. And maybe it's just because I'm paying more attention, but it seems like there's a desire for this kind of renewal in the labor movement and its action orientation. Where do you see the next 2 years taking us? What do you expect from a hopefully in-person convention in 2 years? What's your sort of 2 minute going thoughts back on the future?
Yeah, going back to the CLC, kind of the high level, the thing that would be relevant to any of your listeners if they're interested in labor at all. I hope that 2 years from now, the CLC convention struggles with the fact that they elected a group that was going to ostensibly be the change ticket. And in the end, I suspect we're going to get more of the same. We're going to get marketing campaigns, petitions, lobbying, and no movement on fundamental issues. We're going to continue to see perhaps not statistical decline in union density, but we are not unionizing new sectors of the economy. So we have entire swaths of Canadian identity that has no union relationship to speak of. And this is something that the CLC ought to be responsible for. And I will look forward to being proved wrong that these things are of interest to the CLC leadership, but I suspect that it will not be enough. They will not be interested enough to actually make some fundamental changes to what CLC does and how it does it. And so come the next convention, which I do absolutely hope and expect will be in person, I hope that the membership, the delegates there, are going to bring some real frustration to the floor. And I hope that also translates into a leadership candidate or slate of candidates who are willing to make that the issue of their candidacy, to say that enough with talking about, you know, change and rhetoric. I'm here because I have a specific plan on reallocating labor resources to do something completely different than what's being done right now. And that's happened before, notably in 2014 under Hassan Husseini, who I believe was also supported by the Action Caucus. I was not involved in union stuff at the time, but that was what he tried to do, and it resonated strongly with the floor. And unfortunately, he did not have the votes to win. But I think that putting forward candidacies just with the calculation of what's going to get 51% of the vote is the wrong way to go. We need to build a alternative view of the union movement, an action-oriented view, and that is a multi-year process, and it involves a lot more losses than it does wins, but it is still absolutely worth doing.
Well, thanks so much, Sean. Where can people find you if they want to hear more from you and see what you've been up to?
Absolutely. So I do absolutely encourage people to check out People's Voice in the labor section. You will see some commentary from the CLC.
Good evening. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio, from drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. I'm your host, Sarah De A, recording from home on Thursday, August 19th, 2021. On tonight's show, my guests. Ange Loft, the Centaur Theater's first ever Indigenous artist in residence.
I was trying to explain what my next career thing would be, and I said, you know what, I want to be an archaeology artist. And I was like, what is that exactly? I'm just making up a job for myself, which more or less means that by the time I'm 50, I would love to be able to walk into an archive in any place within Ganyakahaga territory and be comfortable.
Emily Rioux of Osez en Solo and Danse par cas par cas.
And we tried it. It was a whole new thing last year, and it worked so well that we decided to go for another round this year.
And Lea Philippe of Street Theater Festival FAR.
Make discover artists like puppet artists or clowns and dancers and people that don't necessarily known by a large public. So it's a very, very amazing opportunity. We're really lucky and grateful.
Back in fall 2020, the Centaur Theatre in downtown Montreal launched a discussion to decide how to better attract diverse candidates to the space. The theatre applied for new granting from the Conseil des Arts de Montréal to prioritize Indigenous voices. And so, at the start of 2021, the Centaur put out an appeal for a